Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person.
It's a symbol.
An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
Oh yeah, we're going to talk about the pagans today. I mean, we're going to talk about a lot of stuff, but we're talking about the pagans. Now, when we're done with paganism in regard to Christmas, I want you to take a deeper dive. There's a series called The Pagan World, Ancient Religions Before Christianity. It's taught by Professor Hans Friedrich Mueller at the Great Courses Plus. Now, honestly, you know, the more he got into the ancient deities of Mesopotamia, the awesome Egyptian gods, the gods of Olympus like Zeus and Aphrodite, etc., I kept thinking to myself, you know, this is so much more interesting than Christianity, but that's just me. It's The Pagan World, 24 chapters of video or audio streaming right to your computer or via the Great Courses Plus app. Right now, my listeners can check out any course, any lecture for free. In fact, you get free access to their entire library. So don't wait any longer. Sign up today with my special URL. Start your free trial at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. It is once again that time of year. We talk about Christmas. I have a feeling there's a possibility that a Christian apologist has already stumbled upon this show. And before they even hear what I'm about to say, especially here in the front end of the show about the biblical nativity, already they are mashing into an email all the reasons that I am wrong. Like I haven't said a thing about the Jesus story in the Bible, but they're already typing in a refutation. Whatever's coming out of his mouth, we know it's bogus, probably evil, right? It's just wrong. What did I say? Nothing yet, but I'm wrong. Hang on just a second. Stop typing at the keyboard and let's just talk about the nativity story because I am going to say something somewhat controversial. I'm going to ask the question about the baby Jesus. All Christianity loves the baby Jesus. You know, that cherubic, pure face and the wide eyes and almost a smile on the face of the Christ child. You know, the Christ child. You got to figure that Jesus as a baby, you know, he never fussed, he never cried, probably never shit his diapers, right? He was perfect. That baby Jesus, he was the absolute perfect child, wrapped in swaddling clothes and being held by his mother, the Virgin Mary. And there's Joseph, and there's the angels and animals all around. Even the animals are smiling, and there's music, the beautiful baby Jesus. And so to celebrate the baby Jesus, we see Christians going out to the retail stores, and they buy the little plastic baby Jesus. Oh, look, there he is on the shelf. He's all boxed up for us, $29.99 on sale, and you can plug him in. You take him out to the front of the yard, and you plug baby Jesus into an extension cord. He's got a light bulb inside of him, and he just illuminates, which makes him look even more pure and holy. Oh, it's so beautiful, the nativity story. What if this baby that is being celebrated all around the world, what if the baby Jesus was, in fact, the villain of the nativity story? Like, you can't even process it. A lot of people can't even process that. What? Is he lost his mind? Let's talk about the nativity. I have questions. And I think before we get into the etymology of Christmas and the actual origins of many of our Christmas traditions, which I think we really do need to do, it's fascinating stuff. We got to start with the Bible, because especially here in the United States, it's the biblical nativity, the biblical Jesus story, that is the centerpiece of the holiday. So let's talk about it. In the New Testament book of Luke, there was an angel. His name is Gabriel. And he traveled to Nazareth, and he paid a visit to a teenage virgin. It says she's a virgin in the New Testament. I'm going to get to that in just a moment. But she's an unwed girl, a young girl. And Gabriel, the angel, says, hey, congratulations. You are about to get inseminated by a ghost. Now, let me read you the Bible passage. This is out of Luke chapter 1, verse 28 through 35. And listen, as I recite these verses, notice what you do not hear in the passage. Okay, verse 28. When the angel entered her home, he greeted her and he said, "You are favored by the Lord. The Lord is with you." She was startled by what the angel said and trying to figure out what this greeting meant. And the angel told her, "Don't be afraid, Mary. You have found favor with God. You will become pregnant, give birth to a son, and name him Jesus. He will be a great man and will be called the Son of the Most High." Skipping down to verse 34, Mary asked the angel, "How can this be? I'm a virgin." And the angel answered her, "The Holy Spirit will come to you." That's an unfortunate phrase, I think. "The Holy Spirit will come to you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the Holy Child developing inside you will be called the Son of God." Okay, what's missing from the verses that I just read? The angel arrives. He says, "Hey, Mary, congratulations. You've been chosen. You're going to get pregnant with a God-man." At no point in the passage does Mary actually give her consent. Gabriel didn't look at Mary and say, "You know what? I got a golden opportunity for you. It's a one-time offer, and I encourage you to take it. But the choice is yours." Gabriel doesn't say that. Gabriel doesn't say, "Hey, you know what, if you'd like to be the mother of God, check this box." Gabriel doesn't give her a choice. "Hey, Mary, here's the news. You better stock up. You know, go out and get some diapers and some goat milk Gerber food. Because your body, which doesn't belong to you, is going to be used. It's going to be a vessel for a male God who has declared that he needs your uterus to save the world. Enjoy the pregnancy." And the whole Christmas story in Christianity revolves around this pregnancy. The Immaculate Conception, Jesus born of a virgin. By the way, I've got to mention here that the word virgin, this is actually drawn from the Old Testament. The impregnation of Mary is supposed to be a fulfillment of prophecy. But if you look at the word used for virgin in the Old Hebrew, it's a mistranslation. It didn't mean that Mary had not had sex. It just meant that she was a woman who was of childbearing age, pretty much like everybody else in her community. Okay? Oh, look, she is of childbearing age. That's what the word Alma meant when it was applied to virgin or the Virgin Mary. That's not all that miraculous, is it? So fine, you've got an unwed teenager, and she has to now sell this story to the neighbors. Now, let's bring Joseph into the story. Mary and Joseph were betrothed to each other. Betrothed? That's a word that I think stops sounding like a word the more you say it. Betrothed. It comes out of an Old English word, which means to be thoroughly pledged. Essentially, Mary and Joseph were engaged, right? They were promised, but they were not yet married. So now, the teenage girl, still a virgin, living in a hugely Puritan time and place, she gets pregnant. Imagine you're Joseph. That's got to be an alarming thing. Oh, my girlfriend, my fiance is pregnant. I don't remember us actually doing anything. Mary shows up and says, "Hey, Joseph, look, I'm pregnant. Okay, I'm pregnant, but relax. It was not another man. I did it with the Holy Spirit, or the Holy Spirit did it with me, I think is probably a better way to say that. I didn't really have a choice. God says, hey, this is perfectly reasonable because God needs my kid to grow up and save the world. But hey, look at the bright side, Joseph. Even though it's not your child, you get to raise him. Yeah, I can imagine. Joseph, at this moment, he's having what esteemed Bible scholars might call a what-the-fuck moment. And he was allowed by Mosaic law to divorce Mary publicly, which makes no sense to me, because they weren't married. But the Bible takes specific pains to tell us. Well, you know, Joseph was allowed to divorce Mary and do it in full view of the community. But how could he divorce her if they weren't even married? They were only betrothed. Well, the apologists like to jump in and they say, well, the engagement is actually much like a marriage. So if he had divorced the woman that was not his wife, it would be the same thing as if they were married. I'm going to let you chew on that one, okay? And why would he divorce her? Because of infidelity. She got pregnant from what was obviously another man, somebody in the town, somebody who was not Joseph, and she did it before she got married. Now, you're in the neighborhood. You're a citizen of the town, and you see this divorce take place. What is that? It's a public announcement that Mary was guilty of adultery in violation of the sixth commandment. And who's going to believe that cockamamie story about the ghost? I mean, everybody in the town, right? Did you hear the one about the ghost? Oh, yeah, I'm sure she got pregnant with a spirit. You know what? You know who I think it is? I think it's Rufus. You know, just down the road, Rufus, he's the same age as Mary. He's eligible. What about Zachary over at the tabernacle? He says he's celibate, but everybody in town knows he ain't celibate. There's Elias. He has had the hots for Mary for I don't know how long. Maybe they snuck off together. One thing's for sure, sure wasn't a ghost. Why in the world would God set Mary up to be scandalized in this way? I don't understand. God's own laws against unmarried pregnancy, they're severe, especially when it comes to women. God could have simply manifested or miracled Jesus onto the scene like a hero's entrance. There's this cascade of divine light and all of Nazareth. Hell, the whole planet could have seen it if God is able to do anything. He could have pulled a 2001 A Space Odyssey. The baby Jesus, he's encased in this cosmic womb, the size of planet Earth, and it approaches for the whole world to see Jesus. No question, no confusion. The baby is a God come to save humanity. I mean, we can think of 100 other scenarios. Here's one that might save everybody the explanations and embarrassment. Why didn't God simply create a little Jesus sperm? All right, so you wait through the engagement, and then they actually get married, Mary and Joseph, and then they consummate the marriage. And you could just have this one specifically designated special Jesus sperm, right? The magic sperm that belongs to God. And you could have that sperm actually impregnate the egg. After they are married, Joseph's going to raise the kid anyway. Everybody's going to think he's the father. This solves a lot of problems, doesn't it? And because God can do anything, he could guarantee that that's the sperm that won. Hey, go that way, pal. Go on. You know, swim harder. Yeah, oh, there you go. You're close. You're close. Marco Polo, Marco Polo, and bam, Mary is pregnant with the Jesus sperm. That could be the very first miracle that Jesus was involved with on earth. But no, Jesus had to come to earth disguised as an illegitimate pregnancy and a story that Mary could not actually prove to anybody. Well, fortunately for Joseph, he ends up getting off the hook. If you go to Matthew chapter 1, verse 18, it says that one night an angel came to visit him in a dream, and the angel told him that Mary's baby was in fact the Son of God. Now, I'm not sure exactly how dreaming something validates it. Like, Joseph had a dream? How did he confirm that that dream constituted something legitimate and real and tangible for the real world? Was it an actual angel? I mean, we've all had crazy dreams. You know, oh, I dreamed I was swimming in a vat and it was full of cottage cheese. You know what? I was flying and I had wings that were made out of salad croutons. I owned a pet velociraptor and I named him Justin Bieber in the dream. I was visited by an angel. Tell me how you would know the difference between this blender of the brain while you're sleeping and something you could apply to the real world. If we step back to look at the big picture, the New Testament is loaded with contradictions about this nativity story. The book of Matthew says that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and Mary and Joseph already lived in Bethlehem. But the book of Luke says, no, Mary and Joseph did not live in Bethlehem. They actually lived in Nazareth. And so when the census was going on, they had to pack up and travel to Bethlehem to register. This makes no sense, because for a census, you only had to register in the town of your residence. You don't have to travel. So if you lived in Bethlehem or Nazareth or wherever, you just register in that town. Only the male heads of household had to register for a census, not the women. Why would Mary have to take the journey in the first place? And let's say they did have to travel. Why in the world would Joseph put a woman in the advanced stages of pregnancy on a donkey for what would be kind of a dangerous journey for her? Matthew and Luke, these books of the New Testament, not exactly lining up. All right, the census. Known as the Census of Quirinius. This happened in 6 CE. Now keep that date in your head, 6 CE. In the book of Matthew, there was an evil, tyrannical king. His name was Herod, and he was way freaked out about this imminent birth of Jesus, this God-man Jesus, a king that would threaten his authority and power. And so he wanted Jesus dead. He was going to prevent this king from ever growing up into a man. And King Herod ordered the massacre of all newborn babies throughout Bethlehem. And this is part of the nativity story. Joseph and Mary were trying to kind of hide Jesus from Herod so Herod would not kill him. Apparently, God can't defend himself. And so in Matthew chapter 2, after Jesus was born, Mary and Joseph were so scared of Herod that they fled and they hid in the city of Egypt. Now watch the dates on this one. This is after the census of Quirinius in 6 CE. King Herod died 10 years earlier in 4 BCE. So the book of Matthew has them running to hide from a king that's been dead for a decade. And the book of Luke totally changes this story. Luke says that Mary and Joseph did not go to Egypt. They just went back home to Nazareth. And the book of Luke does not mention Herod one single time. Nada. None. Herod is totally omitted from the story. That seems kind of weird. Let's talk about the wise men, or the kings, or shepherds, or magi, or whatever. You know, it's like that song we used to sing as children. You ever sing that song? We three kings of Orient are, right? You remember that song? The wise men followed the star, and they found the baby Jesus lying in the manger, and it was beautiful, and there was gold glitter that fell from the sky and confetti, and the animals were all smiling, and there was Mariah Carey music playing on the radio. It was this beautiful story. We three kings. Well, there's no mention of three anywhere in the New Testament. The book of Matthew says, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, now there's Herod in Matthew, totally omitted from Luke. Behold, wise men came from the east to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him. So the star had led the wise men to Jerusalem toward the Christ child. Let's talk about this for just a second. What is a star? Could you actually follow a star? We all know what a star is. A star is a blazing hot orb of thermonuclear fusion. burns at about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The smallest star on record is bigger than the planet Jupiter. So picture it in your mind. There is a white-hot flaming orb 10,000 degrees bigger than Jupiter, and it's somehow not turning the entire planet into a flaming charcoal briquette. Okay? Earth is not completely on fire. No, no. This star somehow guides the wise men toward a single town in a remote part of the Middle East. I have questions about the star. We have to ask ourselves why the birth of Jesus Christ was celebrated in the month of December. Everybody seems to think that Jesus was born in December. No scholar or historian has been able to demonstrate that. In fact, if you allow for the fact that the shepherds were tending to flocks and other variables, it's probably more likely that any Jesus would have been born probably in the warmer time of year, maybe the spring, early summer, something like that. And beyond the time and place of the alleged birth of the Christ child, again, we come back to my original question. Is Jesus, the baby Jesus, really the hero of our story? Like, why do we need the baby Jesus? Why did Jesus come to planet Earth? To save us all. Saving us from what? He's saving us from damnation. In hell. I mean, if you hold to a literal New Testament, right? Depart from me, all you who are cursed, into a lake of everlasting fire and damnation. Matthew chapter 25, verse 41. You are being saved from hell. Who created hell? God, who is also the baby Jesus. Wait a minute. It's like that Betty Bowers meme where Jesus says, knock, knock, let me in. Why? So I can save you. Save me from what? I'm going to save you from what I'll do to you if you won't let me in. Our torturer comes to earth to save us from being tortured. Why did we deserve punishment? We were created imperfectly from the very beginning. Adam and Eve created imperfectly. They weren't gods, they were humans. What happens when they act imperfectly as they were created? They are immediately punished, and then they infect billions of people with a sin nature which requires a host of carnage and suffering and a meat grinder of bloodshed throughout the Old Testament, spilling into the New Testament, until finally God decides that he needs to have himself birthed as a God-man so he could walk the earth for 33 years doing some really wild-sounding stuff that can't remotely be verified. His decades of preaching and teaching and doing magical things, a precursor to an unspeakably horrible torture and execution to save us from the damnation that Jesus himself created. I have questions about God's perfect plan. We hear Christianity always talking, well, the Lord has a plan. It's all part of God's perfect plan. Wait a minute. So God exists. He lives beyond time. He sees everything, past, present, future. This is before the creation of the universe. He's already seen forward. He's seen the creation of the stars and the planets, and there's Earth and Adam and Eve and all the stuff that goes down. And then he sees the nativity story, and he sees that it's going to require, for some reason, require human sacrifice or God sacrifice in this terrible manner, execution by crucifixion. I mean, that's just horrific. So instead of going back to the drawing board and saying, let's draw up a better plan that's not going to fail at the very beginning and then fail again on multiple occasions, let's go back, since I'm God, and let's make a better plan. God does not do this. The jaw-droppingly imperfect, perfect plan must proceed. Then things go totally off the rails. The shit's hit the fan. The devil's gone rampant. By the way, this is the same devil that God created in the first place. All of this requires blood atonement. Blood must be shed. Somebody explain the whole idea of Yahweh being constrained by any requirement. Omnipotent God, he's required or has a requirement? Wait a minute. He made the rules. The Old Testament's full of stories of blood atonement. They're always bringing the animals to the altar and they're sacrificing the animals in a horrible way and they're bleeding all over the place because God needs blood. Okay, there has to be a blood atonement for the sins of humankind. You got to have blood. And the same was true with Jesus Christ. Whole reason he came to earth was to shed his blood, a blood atonement or blood magic, to supernaturally manifest forgiveness. Why would God require this? God could simply snap his fingers and say, hey, I forgive and save you. It's just as easy as that. It reminds me of the Noah's Ark story. We always talk about Noah's Ark and how unnecessary all of this craziness is. Let's just allow that the entire planet, except for Noah and his family, the whole planet is evil. Everybody's evil. Okay, that's a stretch. But let's say we agreed with that. God doesn't simply just vaporize the evil people. He could snap his fingers and say, and you're out of there. But God could have turned him into something. You know, he could have really gotten creative. But no, God needs a stadium-sized watercraft built, and he needs kangaroos to somehow hop to the desert of the Middle East from Australia, and he needs penguins to waddle to the Middle East to board a boat in the middle of the desert, velociraptors and hamsters, I mean, whatever. He needs them all to live on this boat together to float for a year before everybody parks on a piece of land that no one can find, and Noah and his family then populate the planet with incest. Okay? This is a lot like that scenario. It's unnecessarily complicated. And I have to come back to this whole notion that God would require an offering or blood sacrifice, because God shouldn't require a thing. And at the end of the day, whose fault is all of this? Who is the one who is threatening and sentencing humankind to damnation? The villain of the story, the baby Jesus. Christians, I'm just saying, when you go down to Costco and you pick up the plastic baby Jesus for $29.99 and you plug him in, you stick him on your front lawn, and you are celebrating the child, just know that you are almost certainly celebrating the villain of the nativity story. You are honoring and praying to and singing Christmas carols about the bad guy. Now, the Christians who have heard the stuff that I have just said, who are already indignant and absolutely outraged, are going to hate our next segment, where I inform them that most of the stuff that they do to celebrate the Christ child ain't actually Christian, and they are in effect practicing paganism. Oh, this is one of my favorite parts. And we are going to do it right after this. We're talking about the holidays. If you'd like a special video greeting, like a holiday greeting from me to somebody you love, I'm on Cameo at cameo.com. You can just search my name, Seth Andrews. I've been sending out these phone video greetings. Helps to support my work, and honestly, it's just a lot of fun to do. So if you know, got a special occasion other than the holidays, or maybe just a Christmas thing, I'd love a chance to greet the loved one in your life. Just search my name, Seth Andrews, at cameo.com. I live in Strawberry Red State, Oklahoma, and they love them some Jesus. I used to be one of them, right? Jesus is the reason for the season. I was on 1170 KFAQ radio. This was, 2005, something like that. I was guest hosting the morning show, and it happened to be in the month of December, and I had totally bought into this war on Christmas narrative. They're coming for Christ. They're coming for Christmas. They want to strip away the holiday. They want to say, happy holidays, because they hate Jesus. I had actually bought into that, and I remember kind of selling that on the air. They were a Fox News affiliate, so that's no surprise. Yet I, like millions of other Christians, had not actually done any homework or digging on the holiday to see what's up. I mean, like, where did Christmas come from? I go home, I get a Christmas tree, I've got logs burning in the fireplace, mistletoe hanging over the door, we've got gifts all over the place, we've got all kinds of symbols, we got Santa Claus, you got Santa Claus. Wait a minute. These are not Christian symbols. Well, you're already a step ahead of me, but let's proceed. In ancient Rome, there was a feast and it celebrated the solstice. Now, the solstice, of course, represents the point where the days began getting longer. During the fall and winter months, the days get shorter, the temps get colder, the crops freeze over. But the solstice, well, that represents the point when the sun is coming back. It's going to get warmer. The days are going to get longer. And it appears that our ancestors observed the winter solstice as far back as the last part of the Stone Age, around 10,000 BCE. They found Neolithic monuments in Ireland and Scotland that were aligned with sunrise specifically on the winter solstice. Maybe a way for our ancestors to try to capture the sun, at least as best they could, on the shortest day of the year. It's even speculated that Stonehenge might have been used for December rituals involving the sunset. Ancient Rome celebrated the solstice around the 25th of December. In fact, it said December 25th was the birthday of Mithra, this invincible Persian sun god, Mithra. And it's true that Mithraism and Christianity have a lot of suspicious commonalities. Mithra is at least 4,000 years old. That legend has changed and shaped its way from Persia and the Greeks and the Babylonians and the Mesopotamians and beyond. Mithra, like Jesus, was considered the light of the world. Mithra was a heavenly father who received his minions into their heavenly mansions. Does that sound familiar? Mithra was honored at this great big feast that was held in the month of December, and the centerpiece of the party was a sacrifice, probably a bull, and the people ate bread and they drank holy water. At some point, they think that was wine, all of this revolving around the god who was the sun. Now, if that sounds a little bit like the biblical Last Supper, I think there might be some correlations to be drawn there. The ancient Romans, especially in the upper classes, they often would celebrate the birthday of Mithra. The big party was Saturnalia, in honor of Saturn, the god of agriculture. All right, we're tracking. I've thrown out a few gods. We've got Mithra, the sun. We got Saturn, agriculture. Now, because the sun is bringing the warmer weather, these mostly pagan people wanted to appease the god of agriculture, Saturn, so they would have a bountiful harvest. The festival of Saturnalia actually started as a one-day thing, and it eventually extended to a full week, which began on December the 17th, ending December the 24th/25th, okay? And during Saturnalia, everything else ground to a halt. Nobody really did anything else. They wouldn't work. All businesses were closed down. The courts of law were suspended. Social activities pretty much non-existent outside the big party. Everything and everybody revolved around the festival. And the Roman pagans would decorate their houses with wreaths and greenery. And green plants, like the evergreen, they had a special meaning for people who lived in the harshness of winter, right? All the trees and the grass and everything else, all the plants, the harvest, everything died except for the evergreens. And it was believed that evergreens would keep away the forces of darkness, witches, ghosts, evil spirits, even sickness and disease. And so families would adorn their homes inside and outside with pine and spruce and fir trees. They'd put evergreen boughs and they'd hang them over the door. These trees and plants were very special things. They didn't die during the coldest time of the year, and they kind of served as a reminder of the green plants and all the lush greenery that would again grow when the sun god returned with the warmer weather. So people would literally deck the halls with boughs of holly, like the song says. By the way, the plant holly, that was the symbol of the pagan king of winter. Saturnalia, singing, dancing, feasting, socializing, gambling, and exchange of gifts took place between family and friends. Gifts, that's another piece of the pagan puzzle. And to signify the return of Mithra, the sun, the light of the sun, they would light these wax taper candles, and they were gifted to other people who would then light the candles. The Christmas candle finds its roots among the ancient worshippers of the sun god Mithra. By the way, there were lots of versions of the sun god. The ancient Egyptians, they had Ra, Ra was obviously a sun god. He had the head of a hawk, and he wore the sun like a fiery disc in its crown. And it said during the cold winter months, he would become kind of sickly, and the warmer weather would rejuvenate him. And so they wanted to, you know, root for and welcome in the warmer weather so Ra could again, I guess, achieve his ultimate form. The Scandinavian Vikings also had their sun god, a god named Balder, and the evergreen was the special plant of that particular deity. But around the 4th century, Western Christian churches were starting to settle into celebrations of their own Christmas holiday, and of course they decided December 25th made a lot of sense. It's strategic. Now this is a lot like what the Catholic Church did with Halloween. Now, Halloween was essentially a Celtic tradition involving the Druid priests and the people dressing up in masks and tricks and treats, very pagan. And the church was coming in going, well, we can't have all this paganism, but people sure like the holiday. So the Catholic Church sort of redressed it, made it All Saints Day, All Saints Eve, or Halloween, changed the date, stamped a brand of ownership on it, and said, aha, now we, the Catholic Church, own the holiday. Christianity did much of the same thing with the festival of Saturnalia in the month of December. Now, the pagans and Christians kind of coexisted at first, right? They didn't always get along. They were not always on good terms. But they mingled together and they kind of lived around each other. And then all of a sudden, in 323 CE, Rome adopts Christianity as its official religion. This is 323 CE. So all these party favors and all the traditions of Saturnalia, well, they took those and kind of changed them up, and they attached them to the Christ story as the culture continued its religious evolution. With the Christmas tree, it took a while for this particular tradition to catch on, at least in its current form. It was 16th century Germany credited with the Christmas tree tradition that we are familiar with today. A lot of people still wary of Christmas trees. Queen Victoria finally validated the Christmas tree tradition. This was 1846. She and Prince Albert were depicted in the Illustrated London News. This drawing of them and their family, they're standing with the children and they're standing around a Christmas tree. Now, before this, Christmas trees were still considered somewhat pagan. But Queen Victoria was really popular, and after this image went out, it became accepted in the public milieu. This was not the case in the early Americas. In fact, even in the mid-1840s, Americans were largely offended by Christmas trees for being far too pagan. The second governor of the New England Puritans, a guy named William Bradford, he called the trees, quote, pagan mockery. And people were actually penalized. I guess this was considered a form of blasphemy if they attempted to celebrate Christmas with evergreens. But of course, public perception soon gave way, and the Christmas tree was popularized in the United States. What are some other Christmas traditions? Well, if you've ever kissed under the mistletoe, you might be surprised to learn that you are engaging in a tradition that dates back thousands of years. Ancient cultures used to think that mistletoe had magical healing powers. The Greeks would use mistletoe for everything from menstrual cramps to ulcers. They even used it to try to cure or prevent epilepsy. But around the 1st century CE, it was the Druids, the Celtic priests, they came to see mistletoe as a symbol of vigor and life and even reproductive potency. In fact, the Druids would engage in treatments, whatever those were, for humans and animals who were having problems with fertility. Norse mythology has a great mistletoe story. It involves the great war god Odin, the father of Thor. He was called father to the gods. Odin likely came out of the myths of the early Germanic people. Odin is derived from Woden, or the Old English word for the fourth day of the week dedicated to this particular god, Woden's Day, or Wednesday. And yes, we have named our days of the week after decidedly non-Christian gods. Wednesday remains Woden's Day, or Odin's Day. Well, Norse prophecy says that Odin had a son. He was a god as well. It was Balder. We mentioned him. Baldur was destined to die. He was destined by prophecy. And so Odin's wife, Frigg, the goddess of love, by the way, Frigg is where we get the word Friday. Frigg, she scoured the earth and she talked to all the animals and even the plants. She consulted with all living things and she begged them, please, don't ever turn against my son. Don't ever allow harm to come to him. Please don't kill my son. She had this conversation with all living things, but apparently Frigg neglected to consult Mistletoe. And so the scheming god, Loki, well, he took the mistletoe and he crafted an arrow out of it. And that was the arrow that was used to ultimately kill Baldur. Now, apparently, along the way, the story was given a happy ending. You know, at first he just died, but somebody came along, I guess, and tacked on a happy ending where the other gods got together and they had Baldur resurrected. And so as he had once again returned to the living, or the living world of the gods, his mother, Frigg, declared Mistletoe a symbol of love, and she vowed that she would kiss anybody who ever passed underneath it. 18th century England had its own mistletoe tradition. It started with the lower classes at first, people working blue-collar jobs and servants, etc., but it caught on among the elites. In this tradition, men were allowed to steal a kiss from any woman who stood under the mistletoe, and if she said no, that meant bad luck. There was another version of the story that said you kiss once for every berry. So after you kiss under the mistletoe, you reach up and you pluck a berry and you kiss until the berries are gone. It's believed that our modern-day Christmas carols have nothing to do with the birth or life of Christ. Thousands of years ago, throughout Europe, the pagans would sing songs. They would dance around these stone circles, possibly to ward off evil spirits and appease the good ones. They used to sing all year, winter, spring, summer, fall, every season, but it was the December tradition that's the one that stuck. By the way, the word carol, possibly derived from a Latin word, carula, that means circular dance. But the dancing part of Christmas carols really didn't last long. It was the singing that stuck. The origins of the Christmas carol are cloaked in a cloud of mystery. But it makes sense, right, that Christianity would latch itself on to yet another pagan tradition. I will let you go down that rabbit hole if you feel so inclined. Of course, we can't talk about Christmas without talking about Saint Nicholas, Saint Nick, Santa Claus. You know, it's interesting that Santa's origin story actually harkens back to the land of the Vikings in Scandinavia and Northern Europe, specifically the god Odin. Norse tradition says that Odin would appear during the winter solstice celebrations for something called the Wild Hunt or the Wild Ride. And Odin would be at the front of this long line of parading gods in the sky, and they're swooping around. Odin mounted on a flying eight-legged horse, the legendary beast Sleipnir. Now, this is the horse that's arguably most famous for being the beast that Odin rode into Ragnarok, which is the great battle at the end of the world. Odin, an imposing, almost terrifying specter, hooded and cloaked and boasting a big white beard, a god of the north. He was Odin. He could strike great fear among the mortals. And yet it's also said that Odin had a soft side. He loved a good party. And so this ghost parade, the Wild Hunt or the Wild Ride, it would swoop over villages and homes, and they would terrify people who were wandering around. But also, Odin would drop toys and candy. It says that some of the children in villages would leave out straw for Sleipnir the horse. And as a reward, Odin would show his gratitude. He would slip down their chimneys and the fire holes in their roofs, and he would leave gifts and rewards, according to legend. We can see how the Odin story has informed our Santa legend of today, the legend of Gift Giver, Father Christmas, Old Man Christmas. He was depicted in illustrations dating back to the mid-17th century. Our modern-day Santa is also an incarnation of a Christian saint from the 4th century, a guy named Saint Nicholas of Myra. So St. Nicholas was a real guy. And he was famous for giving gifts to the poor. There's a famous story that has St. Nicholas giving a dowry to young girls. They were poverty-stricken. They felt like they had no other options. They were about to sell themselves into sex slavery. And St. Nicholas snuck into their houses, I guess, and left them a dowry of money so they would have resources, and it changed the course of their lives. St. Nick, the patron saint of a great many causes, probably most famously the patron saint of sailors and children. St. Nicholas, beloved in his life, after he died on the 6th of December, 343 CE, people would honor his memory. And they did so on that day, December the 6th. And to honor him, they would give gifts to each other. The date, December 6th, eventually moved in many places to the 25th to coincide with Christmas. But December 6th remains a popular holiday in places like Belgium and the Netherlands. By the way, St. Nicholas is pronounced in Dutch as Sinterklaas. And of course, you are hearing the roots of Santa Claus. So many variations on the Sinterklaas story throughout the years and the cultures. St. Nicholas spilled into American popular culture back in the late 1700s. Dutch immigrants brought the story here, and they would mark that December 6th occasion in his honor, and people started to take notice. It was a few decades later, 1809, Washington Irving helped to popularize Sinterklaas stories in a book. The book was called The History of New York, but it was the famous poem of Clement Moore. It was published December 23, 1823, in the New York Sentinel. And that poem really informed our modern-day notions of Santa Claus. Of course, you know the poem. It's officially called A Visit from St. Nicholas, but you and I know it better as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. I debated on whether to actually read the poem. You know, it's a poem that we talk a lot about, but we don't really read or hear quite a bit. It goes like this. 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave a luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes did appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment he must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away, all. As leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he'd flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk and laying his fingers aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night." Here's a little piece of trivia. Perhaps this relates to Santa going up and down the chimney, but the original incarnations of Santa Claus in this way had him being miniature, not a big guy, but small, like an elf himself. That perception wasn't really changed until the early 20th century, and I'll get to that here in just a second. But here we have the pretty clear descriptions of Santa Claus in terms of his features: a broad face, rosy cheeks, twinkling eyes, the white beard, the belly that shook like a bowl full of jelly. By the way, this is the first time that we ever hear the reindeer names. This is when the reindeer were introduced, excluding Rudolph. There was no Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in the Santa story, at least not yet. Only the original eight. And that was the case for about 100 years, until 1939. Rudolph was the brainchild of a copywriter who was working on an ad campaign for Montgomery Ward in Chicago. And every December, the store would give away free books to children. Every single Christmas, they would give away these books. And there was a copywriter working for Montgomery Ward. His name is Robert May, and he created a reindeer character. And this reindeer character was kind of a reflection of his own life. Robert had been a bit odd growing up. He was an outcast. He was younger and smaller than most of his schoolmates. He was a nerdy kid. He often kept his own company because the other kids would not give him the time of day. So he saw himself as kind of a loser, a failure, a freak. This was part of how he had grown up, the childhood backstory of copywriter Robert May. And so in 1939, as part of a children's book promotion by Montgomery Ward, Robert May created a new character, Rudolph, the outcast reindeer who just needed a shot. You know, he just needed a chance to show the world why being different was something that should be embraced and celebrated, and why we all have something to offer this world if we're just given a chance to do so. And that year, Montgomery Ward printed more than 2 million copies of Robert May's book. He got letters from all over, from children and teachers and store managers. This supposedly silly little story about the red-nosed reindeer catching on like wildfire. Robert May had a brother who was a songwriter, and they worked on turning the Rudolph story into a song. Yes, that song. They got just a little bit of radio airplay in New York at first, but the song really didn't catch on until Christmas of 1949. An American singer, country singer, named Gene Autry. He was known as the Singing Cowboy. And yes, he looks exactly like you would think a singing cowboy would look. Gene Autry recorded the song and he took it to number one on the charts. Now, it's funny, because Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the song, was actually supposed to be the B-side of a record, which is the afterthought, right? The hit song, that's the A-side, and the B-side was just like, just throw something on there. Gene Autry originally didn't want the song. He'd rejected it. He said, there's nothing here. I don't want to do this. But Gene Autry's wife just kept pawing at him, and she said, put it on the record. And so he caved. The album released, went to number one, a phenomenon was born. Rudolph became the ninth reindeer, leading the pack with his shiny red nose. Here's one more piece of reindeer trivia for you. There is rumored to actually be a tenth reindeer. Now, I tried to do some research on this, and it's spotty. But apparently, the tenth reindeer is Bruno, the brown-nosed reindeer. And the story is that he's slow and he has trouble stopping quickly. And so he's behind another reindeer who stops abruptly. Bruno
the brown-nosed reindeer. I don't know. I don't know what to do with that. All right. That sounds like a punchline to somebody's joke somewhere. Bruno the brown-nosed reindeer. Anyway, he didn't catch on, okay, for obvious reasons. If there was a Bruno at all, you go look up Bruno. Tell me what you find on that. Okay, enough about the reindeer. We need to get back to Santa Claus. We're going to talk about how a pagan god and a Christian saint from the 4th century metamorphosized into the Santa Claus that we see today. I'll give you a hint. One of the major players in this scenario was Coca-Cola. Let me tell you the story and the story of Santa's dark little helper right after this. Kind of went off on a tangent on the Christmas reindeer, on Santa's reindeer, but I wanted to draw things back as we continue to talk about Santa Claus. Where in the world were we in this story? We talking about Odin, we got the wild ride in the sky, we got dropping toys and candy on the good kids. St. Nicholas of Myra, 4th century, known for giving gifts, helping the poor, the patron saint of children. We got Sinterklaas becoming Santa Claus as the legend spread to the Americas. We have Washington Irving's book, Clement Moore's famous poem. Okay, now I've got to talk about Thomas Nast. Thomas Nast is really one of the big reasons that we have our modern-day image of Santa Claus. Thomas Nast was a political cartoonist, and back in 1881, he took the Clement Moore Night Before Christmas poem, and he created an illustration using the poem as the inspiration. He drew out what he felt was a likeness of Saint Nick, and the cartoon was published in Harper's Weekly, and there he was, Santa Claus, for all to see. He was a round figure, big white beard, the bright red suit that was trimmed with white fur, had the big sack that was loaded with children's toys. Thomas Nast also drew the first depictions of the North Pole Workshop and the elves and Santa's wife, Mrs. Claus. Now, I've got a few questions here. I want to know about the elves. Are the elves actually paid for their work? Or are they volunteering their time, like gladly volunteering? Or are they, in fact, slaves? Now, I'm not trying to be a downer, okay? But we as ethical creatures have to ask this question. What's the contractual arrangement to have elves working around the clock manufacturing toys to be shipped out on Christmas Eve? Is there a union? Like, do they have a union? What constitutes a living wage for an elf at the North Pole? Do they live in houses? Do they all live with Santa? Do they sleep on the factory floor on a little mat? Do they have lives, hobbies, and downtime and families? Or is it just work, 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 work inside the world's coldest sweatshop? Again, I'm not trying to kill the vibe here, but elf lives matter. And if they are being marginalized or mistreated, I think it's time for the ACLU to file some kind of injunction. Elves, we got your back out here. We're thinking about you. Everybody else thinks you're an afterthought. We have your back. I want it on the record. Mrs. Claus. Does Mrs. Claus actually have a first name? I've heard speculation about this. By the way, Mrs. Claus was first mentioned in a short story from 1949. It was written by a guy named James Reese. The story was called A Christmas Legend, and he had the first reference to Mrs. Claus. It was the first time the public had been presented with this idea that Santa Claus had a spouse. Apparently, a spouse whose first name was Mrs. I heard one theory that her name is Mary, which would make her Merry Christmas. I think that's just stupid. And one last query along this line. Santa is at least partially based on St. Nicholas. Well, St. Nicholas was celibate. So if that's the case, would Santa Claus actually have a wife? I have questions about Mrs. Claus, okay? But back to Thomas Nast and his depiction of Santa Claus. The Coca-Cola Company started its Christmas advertising back in the 1920s. Of course, we're all familiar. Every December, Coca-Cola has these compelling advertising campaigns. These days, it's the white polar bears and stuff. But Santa Claus has always been part of it, or at least it has been, since the 1920s. And they would put these ads in publications like the Saturday Evening Post, and they started using the Thomas Nast version of Santa Claus in their ads. Mostly, it was a guy dressed up like Santa Claus. You could tell in the early advertisements it was a man in costume. Well, in 1931, Coca-Cola expanded these advertisements, and they enhanced the character of Santa. So he was no longer just a man in the suit, but Santa was a real guy. And this depiction appeared in the New Yorker and Ladies Home Journal and National Geographic and other publications. He was on store displays and billboards and calendars and toys. Santa was suddenly everywhere. In fact, so much of the popularity of Santa Claus can be attributed to a soft drink company, Coca-Cola, and its advertising department. Okay, let's finish big here, shall we? Let's finish the show with the Krampus. And I'm not talking about the abysmal 2015 movie starring Toni Collette. No, that's a terrible film. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the long-standing legend of Santa's partner, the Christmas demon, the Krampus. I did a whole chapter in my book, Sacred Cows, about Santa Claus and the Krampus. I like the way I said it the first time. I'll just play you the clip from the audiobook for free. Christmas tradition in Austria, northern Italy, and other parts of Europe has St. Nicholas visiting eager children with a dark companion in tow, a horned, cloven-hoofed demon called the Krampus. Forget threatening naughty kids with lumps of coal in their stockings. The Krampus will make them sorry they were ever born. The legend of the Krampus spans thousands of years, and like Santa, also has roots in ancient pagan symbolism and Germanic folklore. He's a nasty creature, tall and imposing, often covered in dark hair and flicking the air with a large pointed tongue. He carries rusty chains and slings a large sack across his back, and I'll get back to those. If you're a fan of J.R.R. Tolkien, imagine the Krampus as kind of a Christmas Balrog, and if he ever pops down your chimney, you're guaranteed to have at least one less child to shop for next year. There's a great picture, by the way, that Vince DePorter drew of the Krampus for the book that shows a demon with tongue flicking out and horns kind of protruding through his Santa hat. Very clever. Let's explore a scenario where a family's youngest son, let's call him Timmy, marks an entire year with spoiled, disobedient, and rebellious behavior. While his older siblings toe the line and earn their Christmas visit from St. Nick, Timmy does not. Well, apparently, Santa thinks that kids like Timmy need to be taught a lesson, but he doesn't like to do his own dirty work. So, on December the 5th, which is the eve of St. Nicholas's Day, Santa rushes off for an evening of gifts, merriment, milk, and cookies with all the good children, tasking his pet demon to serve up a naughty list recipe of pain and death for everyone who fell short of the mark. Little Timmy is in for a long night. According to legend, the Krampus will drop by Timmy's house with rusty chain in hand and flog the child mercilessly. Once the boy has been soundly beaten, the demon will cram his still-living body into the sack, and depending on region and tradition, will do one of the following things. 1. Feast upon his flesh. 2. Toss him in the river to drown. Or 3. Drag him down into the fiery pit of hell. It's pretty obvious why an American public weaned on a Charlie Brown Christmas isn't spinning this gruesome yarn around the hearth. Hey, Santa Claus is coming to town, kids, and his demon will fuck you up. But in places like Austria, Romania, Bavaria, Hungary, Croatia, and the Czech Republic, the Krampus is so adored that Krampus Dog or Krampus Day is celebrated with huge and elaborate parades. Hundreds of spectators wait in the streets for the ominous sound of rattling chains and rusty cowbells, announcing the arrival of the Krampus. Packs of costumed men adorned in animal fur, wooden masks, tall horns, and red glowing eyes. As the crowd shouts in terror and delight, it's taunted and teased by Hell's minions. Females join in the taunting, disguised as Frau Bircht, fire-breathing black angels. And there are even mini demons that are played by children. It's a wild, happy, scary, surreal affair, perfect for those who wish that Halloween had an encore. And for the sensitive and squeamish, softer versions of the Krampus figure can be found. Picture the offspring of a Valentine's Cupid and Hellboy, and you pretty much get the picture. Interestingly, there are tiny blips of Krampus celebrations in the United States. But for now, it seems that Santa's happy, harmless reputation is largely safe in this part of the world. He still knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. But the only real consequence will be fewer boxes under the tree. No demon, no chains, no whips, no drowning sacks, no rendezvous with Satan in Hades. The only red you're going to see will be the bright, brilliant ruby glow of flashing Christmas lights. However, if you've got a troublesome youngster in the house and you'd like to take a scared straight approach to behavior modification, perhaps this variation on Clement Moore will straighten the spine of your insolent sprout and make the choice between naughty and nice a bit clearer. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house ran a sniveling, back-talking, spoiled little louse. His parents were thwarted at every attempt and threw up their hands at his sneering contempt. But now he prepared for the gifts he would savor, despite a full year of substandard behavior. He watched near the hearth for the dangling of boots and Santa's big bag with a shit ton of loot. But much to his horror, he didn't see feet. The fireplace ignited with billows of heat. The room turned to crimson, the air turned to steam, and a demon emerged with a deafening scream. It grappled and dangled and rattled its chain. The scourge of Saint Nick, an announcement of pain, along with the stomping of hooves on the floor and glowing red eyes that were vile to the core. The Krampus had come with a present indeed, but one born of avarice, defiance, and greed. It bellowed with laughter, it teased and it taunted, and as the boy begged, it continued undaunted. The striking, the whipping, the snap of the chain, until just a shell of the boy would remain. Then promptly it brandished a bag from its back and stuffed the child into the large empty sack to drag it and carry it into a well that emptied way down in the chasm of hell. With devils and demons and writhing and fire and Satan's throne perched high atop the red mire. Oh, how this young boy wished he'd lived his life better and followed instructions right down to the letter. If he could go back, he would fix his mistakes and undo his crimes with whatever it takes. He'd listen and speak with respect and concern. He'd say please and thank you at every turn. He'd cook and he'd clean and he'd make up his bed, deferring and nodding and bowing his head. Alas, all his chances to change and revoke have gone in a plume of red ash, fire, and smoke. The Krampus came calling to do Santa's bidding. He'd told kids, be good, and he sure wasn't kidding.
So listen, dear children, and don't you forget, that which you've given, you surely will get. Will you get the carrots? Will you get the stick? Will you meet the Krampus? Will you meet Saint Nick? Old Santa is watching, and you're on the clock. And youngsters across this great planet take stock. December will come, and your measure be taken. So act like a saint, or your ass will be bacon. Merry Christmas. We covered a lot of ground today. I sure hope you enjoyed yourself. Thank you for listening. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, whatever. Be safe out there, and I will see you back here next time.